Call calls 0317-735 NRA Catherine Tower LLC. And Mr. Clinton, you're here on behalf of the relator.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And we would also like to save 5 minutes for rebuttal if possible.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This court doesn't have to decide what evidence is relevant to a Section 42.26A3 claim under the Texas Tax Code, because the legislature has already so decided. In terms that are clear, precise, and so unequivocal that they can be given no other meaning, the legislature said, the district court shall grant relief on the ground that a property is appraised unequally if the government's appraised value of the property exceeds the median of the government's appraised value of a reasonable number of comparable properties properly adjusted. As the 14th Court of Appeals has already determined in Harris County Appraisal District versus United Investors Realty Trust, the subject property's market value is not a part of the legislature's formula for determining an A3 claim.
It presumes market value-based valuation by the appraisal district, but you're saying the standard is it presumes it's all been done for the equal and uniform taxation analysis. You just look to what the appraisal district, the values it put on the properties that you're saying are comps, and compare A to B, right?
That's right. You start with the government's assessment of market value.
Right.
That's where market value stops
right.
in the inquiry.
Right.
You take the government's assessment of the market value of your property, you look at the government's assessment of market value of other properties.
Mm-hmm.
You don't reassess market value for purposes of the
right.
provision. And that is precisely what the 14th Court of Appeals ruled in Harris County Appraisal District versus United Investors Realty Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to, you know, the discussion of the case, which is, how do we know what the legislature wanted in this? How do we know what the legislature wanted? Well, we first look to the text. We can look to the text, but we can also look to the context. So let's take a step back. The Texas Constitution provides two very clearly defined guarantees for Texas taxpayers with respect to tax protests. In Article 8, Section 1A, the Constitution says that taxation shall be equal and uniform. In Article 8, Section 1B, the Texas Constitution says that all property shall be taxed in proportion to its value. These are two separate constitutional guarantees. The state or any other or an appraisal entity cannot meet one constitutional guarantee by meeting another constitutional guarantee. They have to meet both. They cannot defend an action under one constitutional guarantee by saying they met a different constitutional guarantee. And every court has recognized that those are two separate and independent rights. So, what has the legislature done? The legislature has divided the statute up so that you can bring a challenge under one of those types of claims under Section 42.25. That is how you challenge the assessment of market value, for which market value is exactly what you are protesting and what you are assessing in the inquiry. And then the legislature wrote a different section, 42.26 of the Texas Tax Code, which is the remedy for an unequal appraisal. And they're clearly defined in the tax code. So you have two separate rights in the Constitution, you have two separate rights in the tax code. But the legislature took it a step forward, because over the course of history of Texas, courts had placed some pretty high barriers for Texas taxpayers to be able to prove an unequal taxation claim. So in 1997, the Texas legislature passed what they called the Texas Taxpayer Bill of Rights. And in the Texas Taxpayer Bill of Rights, the Texas legislature added what is now Section 42.26A3 to the unequal appraisal statute. It was D at the time, it has now become A3. And what A3 does is it creates a very specific formula for determining an unequal appraisal claim. And that is different from a claim under 42.26A2, A1, and A2. And that is exactly the analysis that the 14th Court of Appeals went to in the case that I keep on citing, the Harris County Appraisal District mm-hmm. versus United Investors Realty Trust.
And
is there counsel?
They had a second case that followed that same analysis, right?
Yes, the 14th Court of Appeals has been very consistent. The first Court of Appeals has been inconsistent on this issue, but the 14th Court of Appeals has been very consistent.
Is there any scenario in some kind of 42.26A3 challenge where a private appraisal or some kind of other type of market value data would be discoverable, in your view?
Well, I think that if you are asking for very precise information, I don't think everything in an appraisal would ever be relevant, because there's lots of information that doesn't go to any of the formula that the legislature provided for generating an A3 claim, which again, they passed for the purpose of facilitating these claims. And it has been argued that they passed it for the purpose of removing an independent appraisal from the process. Like, that was the entire purpose of that provision, is to make this claim easy to bring.
Is the real fight here just about finding the sale price?
You'd have to ask our opponent that question.
Okay.
It certainly appears to us that they're trying to get data that isn't relevant to this claim that they could perhaps use against us if
and
we ever brought a different claim.
Hammer you year after year after that.
That would, I mean, certainly that's the argument of the Texas yeah. Public Policy Foundation
well,
and the
well,
8 or 9 or 10 amici that came in that agreed with us. Okay. But I would have to speculate as to what it is that they really want. And I would point out, Your Honor, I think that's a really good question, because if you read the entirety of their brief, they never once identify what it is that they want in this document, not a single time. In the entirety of their brief, they just say, we need it because we need it. We want it because we want it. There might be something in there that we need. There might be something in there that we don't have. And, you know, Texas courts don't, they generally frowned upon a discovery process that is a fishing expedition. You know, you don't just get a right to ask for something because there might be something in that you want.
I do hear them, though, Dar, and I may be going a little out of order here, but
it's okay.
Tying it to the notion that there's some kind of adjustment. You got to figure out what your comps are.
Sure.
Surely there's stuff in this, what we gave the, you know, what Prudential has, the bank, that could be relevant to adjustments.
Yes. And I think that goes to Justice Borland's,
okay.
Borland's question as well. And the First Court of Appeals did say in the UCMB case
yeah.
that insofar as such information will provide, discovery will provide information that goes to the adjustments, location,
yeah.
Size, condition, that would be discoverable. And we're prepared to concede today that we'll give them that information. We will give them the information on adjustments. And the reason why is because I went to their website and they already have it. You can go today, the justices can go today to TCAD's website, and they have all of that information about us on their website, and they have it about all of our competitors downtown as well. It's on their website today.
Okay. I might ought to ask a question here about procedurally where we are. What the record before the trial court, did y'all produce the Prudential docs in camera to the trial court?
We didn't, Your Honor.
It was just the affidavits that y'all...
We had,
before us
and live
here.
Witnesses as well, yes.
Oh, that's right. You called witnesses
yes.
at that hearing.
We had live witnesses and affidavit testimony
okay.
with respect to the evidence.
Well, y'all talk a lot about what may be in that information, but it's not really, we don't have it before us.
We don't have it before us. That's correct.
Okay. So we are kind of fighting this battle about relevance a little bit in the abstract.
Well, I don't think so, because, again, they haven't identified what information they want out of it. They just said they want this document. The courts have said that this type of information is generally not relevant. So if there's some relevant information in it, we're willing to give it to them. What they're asking for is a lot of information that is not relevant, that they have not made a relevance case for, that they have not identified what it is specifically that they want it for. But we are willing to give them the information, the only information that the 14th Court, or that the First Court of Appeals, and really the only information any Court of Appeals has said that they're entitled to that is relevant to an A3 claim, where we are ready to provide that information to them.
Yeah, it might be helpful to have that in writing at some point. I mean, or just clarify.
I will stipulate
exactly
it to it today, but if you'd like,
newfangled tape system, maybe we. but usually, just since we're being fairly specific, if there was something to just specify what exactly.
Right, and I'll be perfectly also honest, Your Honor.
Okay.
The way that this came here is that the trial court flipped sides. The trial court flipped the decision. So the trial court originally said everything has to be turned over, and then said you can redact the information that's irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And we complied with that order. So we actually have already given them that information. And then changed her mind again and said that we had to give them everything. So we had a court order to turn over the redacted version. We complied with it. And then we got a new court order that said we had to give it all. We did not comply with that. and that's when we filed our petition.
There seemed to be some confusion with what the protective order was that y'all were talking about.
It was a truly bizarre set of circumstances where we filed our original motion. It was denied. We mm-hmm. filed a second motion with additional evidence and additional mm-hmm. arguments.
Yep.
It was denied on the merits, but we had a part of it that was requesting a protective order that allowed us to redact the information mm-hmm. that was privileged and confidential and immaterial. That motion was granted, that our request for our protective motion for protective order. There was no other motion for protective order before the court. It's the only motion for protective order. It was ours to turn over redacted information.
So the motion for protective, the order that was granted is what you all are satisfied with.
Well, so what happened then, after our motion was granted, there's an order to compel before the court. We complied with it. TCAD then sends in a proposed protective order, which does not have any redaction in it,
basically,
that the trial court signs.
Basically, it says their eyes only, essentially.
Yes.
Okay.
As the Texas Supreme Court says, you can't cure an abuse of discretion by a protective order. If it's irrelevant, they don't get it. If it's privileged, they don't get it. You can't cure it by saying only they get it. It just doesn't cure anything. Protective order is for the purpose of protecting us if there is relevant and non-privileged information that we turn over to them that is nonetheless confidential and compromising. That's the purpose of a protective order. It's not so that they can gain access to information that is irrelevant and privileged. So they make two arguments. I'll try to address them as briefly as possible. The first is that A3 is merely a reassessment of the property's market value, and that's not true. It is a contest of their assessment of the market value, but it's not a reassessment of market value. The legislature and the Constitution divide up the two types of claims. And no court has ever said that it's the same inquiry, that you just reassess market value all over again. If you did, there wouldn't be two separate constitutional protections. There would be only one. There wouldn't be two separate statutes. There'd be only one. They, at the very end of their brief, say that the basis of an unequal taxation claim is that the property is not taxed at the same proportion of its market value as other comparable properties. Well, if you read the statute, they're essentially reading A1 and A2, 42.26 A1 and A2. That is precisely the analysis in A1 and A2. And the courts have said, even the first Court of Appeals, which is the one that has asked for the most information, this adjustments information to be turned over, has said that A1 and A2 are different from A3. A3 does not require any independent analysis of market value because it doesn't have this ratio analysis that A1 and A2 have in them. So A3 is different from A1 and A2. We only brought an A3 claim. We can talk about specifics if the court would like, but it doesn't sound like the court wants to talk about those specifics of what they've asked for or what we've offered to provide and what's in there. They've really not identified a single piece of information. I guess if they do, I can handle it in reply.
We might also talk about, you know, I guess we've kind of been arguing scope of discovery, relevance.
Right.
You also have or attempted to raise trade secrets.
We
they
did.
Say you're untimely.
Right. This court in Inri Unitrin has expressly rejected their argument. The court already has. It said that there is no timetable for asserting a privilege.
Doesn't that depend, though, on the, and here we're really the timing is dictated. You have to kind of work your way through the cross references within the discovery rules, but it's 205 and 176. So
right.
It boils down to whenever the subpoena says you have to comply, right?
Yes, and okay. Well, I guess. I mean, this court said that you don't have a timetable for asserting a privilege. You do for asserting an objection. But we did. Regardless, we did. We did assert the privilege. I want to, and maybe it's important to state it now.
Okay.
They did not place the subpoena. There was no subpoena in the trial court. I accurately told the court that there was no evidence in the record of an actual subpoena. They filed the notice of intent to file a subpoena in the trial court.
That is the 205.
Not until yesterday did I see a subpoena for the first time. It wasn't even in their motion to file the surreply with a return receipt on it. Yesterday was the first time I saw a subpoena. And that subpoena does not comply with Rule 205, because Rule 205 says that to subpoena documents from a third party, you have to wait 10 days between the notice of the intent to file a subpoena and the actual subpoena. And the subpoena that they you know, gave us in the court for the first time yesterday, does not wait 10 days between the notice of intent to file a subpoena and the subpoena itself. In 205.2, it says, a notice to produce documents or tangible things must be served at least 10 days before the subpoena compelling production, and it does not do
so.
Yeah,
what you have, what you effectively, they'll incorporate into the 201 notice, don't you? I mean, I think the 205 notice, it has to be consistent with 205, but it sort of, it takes account of that initial notice period. Then you have the time to comply once the subpoena has been served.
And
so you're saying that this, although, I mean, it's not the posture. I mean, you're suggesting that there's not, that the appellate, that the subpoena was missing from the appellate record. Here we're on a mandamus.
Right.
So
I mean, being honest with the court as much as I can. This is the first time I saw it was yesterday. It doesn't comply with the subpoena rules for a subpoena and a document for third party. But I also want to say pretty clearly, prior to the first hearing, we asserted confidentiality and we used the word privileged in our reply brief.
Yeah.
So it was asserted. They never objected in the trial court to untimeliness. It is pretty clear under TRAP 33.1 that if you have a problem with evidence being considered, you have got to object and you have to get a ruling. Now they're going to come here and they're going to say that an objection to unfair surprise is the same thing as an objection to timeliness. It's not the same thing. Unfair surprise is when somebody you didn't invite to your party shows up. Timeliness is when somebody shows up three hours late. Those are different arguments. Those are different objections. And either way, they didn't get a ruling. So they did not preserve any objection to the untimeliness of our arguments and briefing, even though we made them timely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. This actually is a mandamus that was brought it originated as a discovery dispute. This is a petition for a mandamus which originated because the TCAT filed a discovery request to a third party. Relators moved to quash it.
Yeah.
This is a discovery dispute about relevancy, which was the basis for the complaint about the subpoena at the original hearing on the motion to quash. Relator's motion to quash cited its basic objection was relevancy. It also cited confidentiality, but never mentioned anything about trade secret. Confidentiality, things can be confidential without them being trade secret. The first time that Relator mentioned a trade secret would have been in their reply to their motion to reconsider. Even at that time, in the motion to reconsider, the affidavit that they attached still only referenced confidentiality, never mentioned anything about a trade secret. The first attempt, again, to present evidence, which is what TCAD argues the Relator has waived, was a day before the submission date. The court had granted them a hearing by submission on their motion to reconsider and had required all of Relator's initial responses or initial motions to be filed by September 22nd, I believe.
What was the time for compliance in the subpoena?
The time for compliance was, as I recall, it was 30 days, or 10 days from the initial notice. But because it is a subpoena to a lender, there's the extra 20 days that the finance code provides.
You have to build in also, I think that's in Rule 205. So it's the 10-day initial notice period plus another 10 days to get the subpoena complied with.
Yes.
Okay, and you're saying all their filings where they raise trade secret explicitly was after that time for compliance?
That it was way after that time for
okay.
compliance. The initial okay. subpoena was issued back in June, I believe.
Okay.
The motion for reconsideration was filed in September.
Turning back to relevance, counsel, the notion of market data and an appraisal and all of this in a particular property when there's a fight over the value, Doesn't it inject sort of an apples to oranges problem? If you're clearly, the appraisal district's putting forth evidence of comps to justify its position, but you wouldn't have a market appraisal or any other kind of particular data, even data about the inside of a house for the other comps. So it's setting the property at issue sort of apart from the comps that at least from a statutory standpoint, the language talks about comps as a starting point.
The comps that the appraisal district would use would probably be comps that the third-party lender's appraisal company would use. The comps for the subject property, TCAD would argue, should be the comps, whoever are their competitors. And since there has been information already out there done by a third party, which would indicate who the competitors are, TCAD's argument is that information is relevant.
What would then stop TCAD from just subpoenaing the commercial property next door's lender's file on that property to get that same type of data?
Well, this appraisal would be specifically for the subject property. And so we're looking for how a third party handled comparing the subject property to its competitors. What adjustments did they make?
And when your burden is to justify the extent to which you have taxed this property relative to others, how is it possibly relevant for you to find out what some third party thought about it? The objective here is the court shall grant relief on the ground that this property is appraised unequally as to other comparable properties. So what, explain to me how it could possibly matter what a third-party lender thought this property is worth. It doesn't, reading the statute 4226A3 that I just read, it doesn't matter if that lender thought this property is valued at $5 million or $5 million. It's irrelevant because the question is, are you all taxing this property equally to the comparable properties around it? Is that not correct?
That what is correct about your statement is that the appraisal district is not interested in what the appraisal company but their final conclusion of what they appraised the property at. What they are looking at are what comparable properties were used, what adjustments and what factors were adjusted for, those are the elements that are required to prove up the 4226A3 unequal appraisal cause of action. In fact, the legislature amended the statute 23.01A suggests that you need to look at market value type factors in valuing a market value of the property on January 1. That had always been codified in the tax code, 2301A. Just last year, the legislature cleared up any confusion about whether there was a different standard for unequal appraisal. And you'll see in 23.01F, the legislature used the exact same language in saying that in developing an analysis to determine reasonable number of comparable properties appropriately adjusted, this analysis must be based, again, on the application of generally accepted appraisal methods and techniques, which would require looking at individual characteristics of the property. Those are contained within this appraisal. It will require looking at who are the property's competitors. That is also contained
is
within the appraisal.
Is that not the job of the appraisal district in the first instance?
That would be in the appraisal district's view of what those competitors would be. But relators have contended that that's incorrect. That's what brings us, we've come here because they've contended that that information
is correct. But applying the statute, it's the job of the appraisal district to come in and say, we've identified comparable properties, we've taxed or assessed this value on subject property, and as it compares to the comps, it's all equal.
And their tax.
You're talking about turning that on its head. We want to find out what their lender thought comps were so that we can know exactly what they paid for this property, which raises a good question. Texas is not a disclosure state, is it? If the appraisal district sends a letter out saying, we notice you guys just bought a property this year, please tell us what you paid for it, but be aware of the fact that you don't have to do that.
That's correct.
By the way, are y'all seeking that information?
The sales price?
Yeah.
Not in this proceeding, no.
Okay.
And I've not seen an appraisal that contains a sales price. Typically, they are appraising the property for the purpose before the contract on the sale has even closed. So typically, I don't believe that they would even know
the purpose of determining a loan amount.
Exactly.
Right.
Typically, the sales price is not in the appraisal that is done for the lender. It's my understanding that since the 2008 crash with the housing market, that was written into law that you can't do that.
But it certainly takes you a ways closer to that target than if you had none of that information, does it not?
But that's not the target when you're looking at unequal appraisal. What the target is in unequal appraisal is, again, looking at who are the competitors, what are the factors to be adjusted, and have we considered all of the factors, depreciation, whatever individual characteristics about the property that perhaps the appraisal district is not aware of.
And so what was it we heard mention of, if I recall correctly, three different orders that were in place here, the second of which sounds like these folks were satisfied with. What is it about that order that the appraisal district was dissatisfied with such that you were moved to go in and have a third order signed?
I believe you're talking about the protective order. Well, what was the initial order that was entered by the court denied relator's objections based upon relevancy, denied their motion to quash the subpoena, and also denied, actually have the order here. It granted their motion for protective order, but it did not state the terms of the protective order. It just says granting a motion for protective order, just as if any two parties would go into court and one party argue for some relief, the other party argue for other relief. The court accepted proposed orders from both sides and decided which proposed order was appropriate, which one actually satisfied what her ruling was. But there had not been a protective order in place prior to the one that was issued on October 18th.
What is it about United Investors that you think is incorrect? Where did the court go wrong there?
There is nothing about United Investors that we think is incorrect. As a matter of fact, we cite United Investors for our point that market value is relevant. All throughout United Investors, it says that you are presuming that the values that you are looking at are market values. If that is the case, we have a recent sale of the subject property in this case. We can test whether that is accurate because we have the appraisal. We can look and see what comparable properties we use, what adjustments were made to see if those market value, if those factors were actually considered in that appraisal. In fact, MHCB, Your Honor, I think is the one discovery case that is out there that actually speaks to the relevancy of a lender's appraisal. If you look at, or I've noted in my briefing, that MHCB was a lender, as a matter of fact. And in this case, the appraisal district had requested, there was a multitude of discovery requests. But one of the requests was appraisals by the lender. That specific request, the court allowed the appraisal district to discover that information. While the court did say that many of the appraisal district's requests in that particular case were overly broad, that particular, in footnote 11, they've excluded request for production number two. And request for production number two was the lender's appraisal.
Was this same information sought from the LLC or just via the third-party subpoena?
It was sought from the LLC. They objected as to relevancy. They did not assert a trade secret in their objections, did not assert confidentiality in their written objections. A second case that has come out some time frame close to the MHCB case was the Corporate Park West case. I've cited that also in the briefing. In this particular case, this was appraisal district prevailed by using market data in its analysis. And that court specifically said that, as a matter of law, market value data as a matter of law, 4226A3 does not preclude the use of market data in determining unequal appraisal. And that is what the appraisal district is attempting to do in this case, is to use market value data in making its assessments about the value for this property. And the other cases that Relator has cited, all of those cases have been trial court cases that have gone all the way through trial. The only discovery case that's out there is the MHCB case. The other cases they cite all say that market value is not required. That is not the same question as if market value is relevant. Looking at whether market value is required to prove your case is actually an admissibility question, but this is a discovery dispute. At this stage of the game, we are not trying to admit this appraisal into evidence for trial. We're simply trying to discover it. It is a fact that we know that it's out there. There are facts about the case, facts about the property that are contained within that appraisal that will help both sides to determine whether this property is unequally appraised. We don't believe that the plaintiffs have appropriately asserted a trade secret privilege. They've cited confidentiality, and the court has addressed their confidentiality concerns by entering into the protective order. That protective order will keep that appraisal from being public. Plaintiffs have mentioned in their briefings that once the appraisal district has it, then it automatically becomes public information, and that is just not true. As a matter of fact, there's a statute in the government code that says when the appraisal district receives information that is confidential, and if a court enters a court order, it cannot be it's not a part of the Public Information Act. So those concerns have been addressed.
Isn't it just from a practicality standpoint, the appraisal district has a lot of work to do doing all these appraisals. Many taxpayers fight it. If this gets opened up into regular discovery where banks are being subpoenaed and you're looking at comps that third parties have put together for particular purposes, maybe a favorable interest rate, and then you've got the taxpayer subpoenaing other third parties to disprove that, doesn't it take away from this big picture view that this is supposed to be a streamlined process. The government is the appraiser. The district is the appraiser here, not a third party. Doesn't it just sort of open this up to some unworkable degree, doubling the workload even of the district, of the appraisal district?
It actually helps the appraisal district in that if that information is already done by a third party, then our appraiser has, that's less research that they have to do.
Yeah, but it's, you only get into this world if you're in a discovery fight in court.
To be honest, Your Honor, we have, this has been a discovery request in these types of cases since these cases have been brought. Since 1998, the appraisal districts have asked for this type of information. And typically it is provided, usually under a protective order, without any objection, well, an objection, of course, but provided under confidentiality. And I was, in my 20 years of practice, this is maybe my second time being in court.
Well, I think a taxpayer could open the door if they march in with their own market value appraisal to show that you guys are way out of line, but it's different in the context of it being objected to, and then it boils down to whether it's required or
relevant.
Well,
typically when the appraisals are in their favor, they do bring them in, which is the problem for the appraisal district. We only get to see it when it helps the property owner. If there's an appraisal out there that shows the how this property competes with its competitors, what the adjustments are, and the relator is already complaining that the appraisal district is doing it all wrong, then this is helpful information for the appraisal district and for the courts to make a decision about that. In my final few minutes, I do want to point out that the appraisal district, that the relators did not meet their burden at the trial court level. They did not show that the they had asserted a privilege, and the trial court ruled on that. The trial court did not abuse its discretion, and this court, TCAD, believes they have not met their burden in proving that there was an abuse of discretion.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, court. Try to address these quickly. I know there's not a lot of time left. One of the most important things that came out, I think, in that was this theory, this theme that it's too early. You guys don't have to decide. We get anything in discovery. That's just false. Inri National Lloyds, recent case out of the Texas Supreme Court, says that immaterial or irrelevant evidence is not discoverable, and it's an abuse of discretion to get it. So it actually has to be material in order for you to get to the next step of whether you can ask whether it would be admissible or capable of producing admissible information. But it first has to be relevant to be discoverable. Irrelevant information is not discoverable. Second, with respect to why you don't see these things a whole lot, well, there's a reason. You can imagine how much it costs for the two of us to have briefed this case over a single document. And that's why you saw 8 or 10 Amici come in and say, please address this issue, because it costs all of us that much money over a single document. And in fact, I've gotten phone calls and emails from lawyers across the state saying, please get a decision in this case, because we can't find coherency in order to hand a case to a trial court that's making these decisions, because our clients can't afford to protest these things. They can't afford to pay the fees to deal with a discovery dispute. It's just too small, and that's why they turn them over. And that's the abuse of discretion that we think is a government going out of its way to what we believe is to deter us from bringing these disputes. So that's why you don't see it a lot, is because it costs too much. And that's why you saw so many Amici coming in and saying, please clarify this area of law. And it does matter now, because irrelevant information is not discoverable. That's black letter law under the Texas Supreme Court. I also want to clarify what I think were a couple of mistaken representations by my friend. I understood it to have been represented to the court that we did not raise trade secrets until the reply brief of our second motion. That is false. On page 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 of our motion to reconsider and second motion to quash, which is record exhibit number 12, we raised the privilege. It is. CBRE appraisal constitutes a trade secret. We could not have been more obvious in saying that. So this idea that they didn't have enough time to object, I mean, several days went by. The court requested a response to this. They filed a response. They actually got, so they filed a response to this, and yet they're claiming that they didn't have time to make an objection to this. I mean, it's kind.
Was that before or after the time to comply with the subpoena?
Well,
and I guess that goes back to what
it
you
goes
said
back
earlier.
To whether the subpoena was properly, you know, noticed. If you don't believe my argument that they had to wait 10 days, which is how I read, the subpoena was not proper because they didn't wait 10 days between the notice and the subpoena itself, then I agree it was later.
Okay.
But I mean, I think this case is decided. I think all the Amici hope that this case will be decided on relevance and not privilege anyway. I think
well,
this case is.
Yeah, trade secret, et cetera, would be what you get to if
we lose on relevance. Right. And I did not hear anything that I felt like I needed to address on relevance. I think it is pretty clear that the information that we provided to them is the only thing that could be relevant to them. They're asking for adjustments. That is what we gave them. They said I think one of the questions was, why was the original order not good enough? Why did you come back again? I never heard an answer to that other than our request wasn't specific enough with respect to redaction. I think that is a misstatement. As well, if the court goes to page 11, we ask for in the alternative plaintiff's request for a protective order allowing for partial disclosure, and that again is record exhibit number 12, and then if the court looks to record exhibit number 15, it says it is further ordered that plaintiffs, not defendants, plaintiffs, that's ours, motion for protective order is hereby granted. So that was our motion that was before the court. That was what was granted. Why TCAD came back and filed a proposed protective order that undid this, I don't know. I think I take as a stipulation again in this court that they don't want sales price, so hope that's good enough that if we lose this, that we still can redact the sales price to the extent it's in the document. But without any, if there's no other questions,
yeah,
I'd
and again,
the
it may be
time.
Helpful to have some clarification about what exactly has been produced. I mean,
if you'd like,
and I think we can do that because it's even if it's not, you know, wasn't. Well, I guess it was before the trial court, but also it kind of goes to our jurisdiction because arguably part of the, you know, some of this controversy is moot if we're not fighting about stuff you've already given up.
Right. I mean, and that was my attempt to make the stipulation is to the extent anything is, you know, goes to those factors.
Well, but what does that mean?
Well, if it identifies location, size, condition, those information we'll give it with respect to us and the competitors. We'll even she said we need to know who we think our competitors are. We'll identify who we think our competitors are as well. And if the court would like, we'll be happy to submit to the court the document that we provided to them.
That might be helpful. Yeah, please do.
Any other questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right. Thank both of you for your presentation. The case will be submitted and considered, and with that, the court will stand in recess.
I'll be right.